Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, my amateur radio call sign N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. We'll be reading together World Radio Online for January 2012. World Radio is published by CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. First of all, a very happy new year to all of you. I hope that your past holidays were fine, healthy, and enjoyable, and that those good feelings of the last few weeks give us a positive start to the new year of 2012. And so as time marches on, so shall we. But first, ouch! U.S. postal rates increasing January 22nd. The cost of a first-class stamp will increase by a penny. To 45 cents as of January 22, 2012. Rates to Canada and Mexico are increasing a nickel to 85 cents, and other international destinations will be $1.05, an increase of 7 cents, according to the U.S. Postal Service. In addition, the cost of mailing a postcard will go up 3 cents to 32 cents. Boy, I can remember way back when it was a penny back in the 30s and 40s. Remember that, some of you old-timers? That's the second postcard rate increase in less than a year. The source there was CQ Newsroom. Our next news piece, KC5ZSX joins fellow radio amateurs aboard ISS, the International Space Station. Dan Burbank, KC5ZSX, joined Expedition 29 Commander Mike Fossum and Flight Engineers Sotashi Furukawa and Sergei Volkov, all amateur radio operators aboard the International Space Station, the ISS, when the hatches opened at 0739 UTC Wednesday, November 16th. Burbank and cosmonauts Anton Skrabtsovlev and Anatoly Ivanochin were aboard Soyuz TMA-22 when it launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan at 0414 UTC Monday, November 14, on its way to the ISS. Burbank, Skrabtsovlev, and Ivanochin are scheduled to live and work aboard the ISS until March. As propagation improves, intruders make trouble on 10 meters. Non-radio amateur intruders on 10 meters are causing more and more headaches as the MUF, that's the maximum usable frequency, continues to rise in solar cycle 24, according to a report by the IARU monitoring system. Issued in late 2011, a report found, quoting here, much CB-like traffic using AM, FM, and SSB, single sideband, between 28 and 29.7 megahertz in September and again in October 2011. According to Amateur Radio Newsline, quoting, it pegs Europe, Brazil, and the Far East as the primary originating points for most of the illegal 10-meter traffic. The report goes on to say that the band is also still filled with numerous taxi cabs operating FM. Oh my goodness, huh? Everybody likes a good thing when the skies open up and the signals bounce better. With conditions improving on the upper high-frequency bands, IARQ officials expressed increasing concern about the illegal transmissions. Russia has agreed to do, quoting here, all it can to improve illegal taxi radio operations from the 10-meter band. But just how successful that move will be remains to be seen. But we still thank Amateur Radio Newsline and IARU Region 1 for that bit of startling information. FCC makes changes to the 60-meter band operation. Federal Communications Commission released a report and order on November 18, 2011, with new 5 megahertz rules, 60 meters, for the amateur radio service. Some of the FCC changes are to now allow Opera sideband phone, RTTY, that's RTTY, data, and CW with specific limitations on the use of these modes. The maximum allowed power level is now 100 watts PEP, effective radiated power, ERP, referenced to a dipole. The FCC has deleted the channel 5366.5, that's 5366.5 upper sideband, the center is 5368.0, and replaced it with 5357.0 kilohertz upper sideband, the center for that 5358.5. For the complete text of the Federal Communications Commission report and order, you could visit the following website, http://fcc.us/vohksr. That was filed by Southgate News Service. One more piece in the news line. Danish study finds no link between cell phones and cancer. The largest study yet of possible connections between cell phones and cancer has found no evidence of any link. The Associated Press reports that the Danish study of more than 350,000 cell phone users monitored over 17 years found there was no increase in cancer risk compared with non-cell phone users. In the United States, both the Food and Drug Administration and the Federal Communications Commission have found no evidence of a link. Fears of a connection persist, however, the story reported, despite the fact that cancer rates have not increased since cell phones were introduced. Well, ladies and gentlemen, World Radio Online is offering a reader survey, which focuses on radio amateurs' operating habits, knowing what times you're most often on the air, on what frequencies, what modes. You get the idea. And if you have internet capabilities, you can visit http://svy.mk/twoxbq. If you are confused about that kind of an internet hookup, just take a few minutes to complete in your thoughts what will help us to better pack WRO with content relevant or entertaining to you. And if there are questions or topics you're curious about, we'd be glad to look into them via this monthly survey. Drop an email with your suggestions to World Radio Online. That's all one word. I'll say again, World Radio Online at gmail.com. And thanks for your consideration. The survey commentary is furnished by Richard Fisher. The editor is Amateur Call KI6SN. Let's take a look at Richard Fisher's log at this point. Go ahead, we're listening. Happy New Year. It's great to be embarking on another publisher's dozen issues of World Radio Online for 2012. A mantra for this year, even better. That each issue is even better than the one preceding. Now that we're settled into our new digital home, we hope to be taking advantage of every tool our magazine producer, Zinio, C-I-N-I-O, has to offer. We want to bring readers the best multi-layered amateur radio publication in the world. That's our technical mission. We'll keep you posted as we continue peeling layers of this onion. Beyond the technical, though, defining better is another subjective matter altogether. Reader input is critical. That's where you come in. Incoming correspondence from readers. You might have noticed in WRO's December edition we kicked off Incoming, a column featuring feedback from readers. We'll make it as regular as our inbox allows. Wouldn't it be great to carry your opinions, suggestions, and ideas every month? We'd sure like that, but it will be up to you, with whatever is on your amateur radio-oriented mind. So you can write to worldradioonline@gmail.com with your commentary. The WRO's monthly live internet chat continued. The third tier of this reader-focused initiative is our WRO Pop com live internet chat sessions. Pop here is Popular Communications. This month's is Sunday, January 8th at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 0100 UTC, Monday, January 9th. Since we started these meetings, GabFests, in early 2011, the chats have been a great place for the radio community, both ham and SWL shortwave listeners, to gather for casual conversation and camaraderie. They are user-friendly, freewheeling, and a lot of fun. Come and go as you please. Stop in just to say hello or carry on for the whole hour or so. The portal into the chats is on the World Radio Online blog. That's www.worldradioonline.blogspot.com. If you like a reminder when chat time is approaching, sign up for an email in the Cover It Live chat window. Let's talk about 10 meters and must reading in CQ. Have you worked 10 meters lately? Conditions have been blowing operators' socks off coast to coast and around the world. Example, at KI6SN. Using the dipole described October 2011's Trail Friendly Radio, we worked Japan on 29.600 MHz FM simplex from Southern California. That's 50 watts into this droopy antenna made solely of speaker wire. It is dangling from the garage rafters about 7 feet above the concrete floor. What a kick! In the CQ magazine Zero Bias editorial this month, editor Rich Moss and W2VU captures beautifully the warmth and excitement that comes when reuniting under this wonderful propagation with an old friend such as 10 meters, which U.S. amateurs are authorized to operate on 10 meters. You may be surprised. This month's Zero Bias is a must-read indeed. That's the editor's log for January 2012, signed Richard Fisher, KI6SN. I'll begin our featured articles now. The first one happens to be with the Handy Hams, a new strategy for helping the blind ham, part one, by Patrick Tice, radio call WA0TDA, Whiskey Alpha 0, Tango Delta Alpha. First, at Handy Hams. We ask a volunteer who owns and is familiar with a particular radio to teach about that radio, recording an audio tutorial series that blind hams will find more useful. Patrick Trice, WA0TDA. Most of us take being able to read a book or an instruction manual for granted. If we take an amateur radio license course, most often we will buy a book and use it in our studies. The print manual packaged with the new radio is a good reference for those of us who can see to read it. For those who cannot read regular print, there must be alternatives. We serve Handy Ham members who are blind or who have a reading disability with accessible website materials that include spoken word audio. These days, computers are excellent blind accessibility tools and are equipped with screen reading software so that blind users can operate them independently. A skilled blind computer user can navigate and read a PDF transceiver instruction manual online. Years ago, there was no other way to access instruction materials except by having a volunteer read the entire contents of the manual onto cassette tape. A master tape then provided unlimited copies for Handy Ham members who had that particular radio. Similarly, licensed study materials used to be available only in print and had to be read by volunteers. Today, there are many other options that include audio compact discs and websites designed to teach amateur radio. None of these options has really been designed from the ground up for the use of blind amateur radio operators. Instruction manuals, for example, even if they can be read by screen reading software, usually contain undescribed diagrams and confusing sidebars and tables that are hard to keep in context. Nothing in these manuals describes where the controls are located on the front panel of the radio because there is a diagram complete with labels, which, of course, a blind person cannot see. Licensing materials contain figures and diagrams as well as mathematical equations that are not described well from a blind perspective. At the Courage Center Handy Ham System, The website there is http://www.handyham.org. Handyham is spelled H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M, one word, www.handyham.org/. We have decided to take a different approach. Instead of simply having a human volunteer read an instruction manual for a transceiver from one end to the other, we ask a volunteer who owns and is familiar with that particular radio to instead teach about that radio, recording an audio tutorial series that blind hams will find more useful. The volunteer instructor will teach the course at his or her own pace, just as if they were explaining the radio to a person on the other end of a telephone line. Licensing classes are taught the same way, with extra explanation of what an algebraic formula looks like or what a schematic symbol looks like. Volunteers can use the free, open-source software program titled Audacity, A-U-D-A-C-I-T-Y, Audacity. Let's take a look at how you can try recording for yourself. Perhaps you will be able to help us produce some new audio tutorials. First, get Audacity. Head for http://audacity.source-forge, that's SOURCE-FORGE.net. Figure 1 is shown on page 16 of World Radio Online this month. Not only is it free, but it will work on several different operating systems. I use Windows, so my choice was the latest release, 1.313 beta. You will also need the LAM MP3 encoder. LAM is L-A-M-E, the LAM MP3 encoder. That is seen on figure 2, which also appears on page 16. In order to create the final MP3 audio files, however, you do not have to download and install the LAM encoder right away. Instead, install Audacity, then open the software and familiarize yourself with the menus. At first, the controls near the top of the window might look a little confusing, but they are not all going to be used for a typical recording session anyway. That illustration appears at the middle of page 17. And those symbols work just as you would expect. Now, with regard to installing and checking your microphone, before making your first recording, you will need to have a microphone hooked up to your computer. All modern notebook computers have built-in microphones, but whether you are using a desktop machine or a notebook, an external microphone is probably going to give much better results than a built-in condenser microphone. I recommend a USB headset microphone. In figure 4, at the top of page 18, you can see the Logitech USB headset microphone I use for my recording. And you can listen to a sample when you finish reading this article and go to the web link that I will provide. For best audio quality, be sure you have a foam shield over the microphone to avoid pops should your breath cross the microphone element. Believe me, it makes a difference. Next, you want to set up your computer's sound. I use Windows 7 Professional 64-bit for sound. And figure 5 on page 18 shows what my sound recording setup looks like. If you are using Windows, find the little speaker in the taskbar on the lower right corner of your screen. Right-click the speaker with your mouse and choose Recording Devices. Click on the Recording tab. Now you should see something that looks like a list of devices from which you can record. And looking at that figure 5 for the listener, it's headed sound. The choices listed in the reproduction here: microphone, high-definition audio device not plugged in. Microphone, high-definition audio device not plugged in. Line in, high-definition audio device not plugged in. Microphone, USB audio CODIS, ready. Microphone USB audio device, default device. That's your selected choice. It's highlighted in the illustration. As you can see in Figure 5, I have several choices here. I have to be sure that I highlight the right one. And I know from experience that microphone USB audio device, which I have set up as the default recording device, is the Logitech USB headset. Had I made a mistake and chose a microphone USB audio CODIS just above it, my recordings would have come from the receiver audio of my connected ICOM IC7200 transceiver. Of course, you can use Audacity to record from a variety of sources, but we will leave that for another time. Next, we have to make sure that our audio levels are correct. Click on the Properties button. On the left in Figure 6, which is at the bottom of page 18, and when the next screen comes up, right in Figure 6, choose the Levels tab and adjust the microphone slider. I discovered that a setting of 73, a number that I can easily remember for some reason, provides a nice waveform for my voice without clipping. However, there is one more adjustment to check. While you are still in that same window, click the Custom tab and then put a check mark in the AGC box. That appears as Figure 7 on the top of page 19. If the audio proves to be too hot or too strong and the waveform is clipped and distorted, you can uncheck this box later on. But I find it is necessary to check it to get adequate volume. Since all computer systems are different, you will have to experiment with your audio settings. Some sound cards don't even offer this AGC feature, so don't be concerned if you can't find it. Now, make your first recording. Now you are ready to make a recording. Go back to the main Audacity screen and click the red record button. That'll be Figure 8 in the illustrations in the middle of page 20. Notice that my USB microphone is selected. Now let's take a look at what a screen of waveform looks like in Figure 9, which is at the bottom half of page 20. The screenshot shows an audio lecture that I have made on rectifiers for my general class students. It is in its most basic raw format, and you can see that there are 9 separate tracks. The recording begins on the far upper left corner. I got into the recording a few minutes and then had to stop. I resumed recording and stopped again, which made the second track. Then I recorded the third track, stopping again before starting the fourth track, and so on. In order to stop the recording, I just used the stop button that has the typical symbol for stop, a square. It's the third bubble from the left in Figure 8 there, the square. When I started recording the next track, I made sure that the cursor was all the way at the end of the previous recording by using the fast forward button. That way I am sure that none of these tracks will overlap. As you might guess, when you are teaching a lesson, there will be times when you will have to stop to answer the phone, take the dog out, look something up in a reference book, or just stop recording because you want it to be done for the day, and work some DX. In order to make sure you don't lose anything, simply use the file menu in the far upper left corner and choose Save Project As, giving it a file name that you can remember and storing it in a place that you can find when you are ready to resume recording. When you do this, Audacity creates an AUP, AUP file, which you will click on when you want to continue the recording. There will also be a file folder with the audio data for the AUP file, and it will be similarly named. Both must be kept in the same directory while you are working on the recording. Get in the habit of saving your work often. Now, with regard to editing and processing the raw audio, my next step is to select all of the tracks and turn them into one single track. Remember, the audio from these tracks cannot overlap That's why you can see in figure 10 on page 21, the audio starting on the far left and continuing all the way through to the far right. In fact, if you want to listen to anything you have recorded, you can just place the cursor anywhere in any of these tracks with a mouse click and then click the round button with the green play triangle to listen. The audio will play from track to track without interruption. Of course, all we need is a single track, so we need to select all of these tracks by using the key combination Control plus A, that's CTRL plus sign A, or the Edit menu on the top and choosing Select All. Next, from the Tracks menu on the top, choose Mix and Render to combine all of these tracks into one single track. That's illustrated in figure 11 at the bottom of page 21. This certainly looks simpler, doesn't it? Now we have a single track, and you can see in figure 11 that the waveform seems okay and not clipped. But there are obvious gaps of silence that we are going to have to edit out. Fortunately, this is easy to do with Audacity. Using the Effect, EFFECT, using the Effect menu at the top, choose Truncate Silence from the pull-down menu. A dialog box appears. You can see that in figure 12 at the top of page 22. And you will need to either use the default settings or enter the numbers that I have put in after experimenting with what works best. I suggest you start with my settings for the best results. The software will then locate and remove any silence in the recording that is longer than 500 ms, that's milliseconds, ms, with a threshold of minus 25 dB used as the standard. Now that the silence has been removed and the waveform looks more or less continuous, you can see that in figure 13 on page 22, we are going to touch up the levels. This is done by going to the Effect menu at the top and choosing Leveler, L-E-V-E-L-L-E-R. A dialog box appears and you can choose the degree of leveling you prefer. I like the light, L-I-G-H-T, the light setting because it produces no distortion. It will help to level the volume throughout the entire recording. Now, with respect to making an MP3 file, an example in figure 14, which appears on page 24, I am recording lecture number 14 in my general class series. Since I have already saved the project with the file name 14_gen.aup, I am now ready to export the file to MP3 format. You may be expecting the more familiar Save As, but Export will do the same thing. You will find the Export, EXPORT choice under the File menu on the top left in Figure 14, again on page 24. If the LAME, L-A-M-E, encoder for MP3 is not installed, you will be prompted to do so now. Follow the instructions. Then you will be ready to continue by entering the metadata, which is optional. I always enter it because it tags the file with relevant information such as a brief description of the contents, the author, and so on. The screenshot is shown in figure 15 at the bottom of page 24. You can save the metadata file separately for use later. Give it a file name descriptive of what it contains, such as General, and hit the Save button. When you click the OK button at the bottom, the actual export process begins. The MP3 file will have the same name as the Audacity project, except with the familiar MP3 file extension. In the figure 16 screenshot, that's on page 25 at the top, you can see the export process underway. The quality level I have chosen for spoken word audio is 40 kilobytes per second, KBPS. That will save space on my hard drive because the file size will be much smaller than if I had chosen the default 128 kilobyte stereo. Almost done. Now I can see the icon of my new MP3 file on my Windows desktop. That's figure 17, also on page 25. It is time to click on the file and listen to the audio to make sure it sounds okay. I use the default player, Windows Media Player, but you might use another player such as iTunes. Note that the file plays and the metadata scrolls across the screen of the player. That's shown in figure 18 at the bottom of page 25. You have produced your first MP3 audio file using Audacity. To listen to a short sample of the audio lecture that was shown in the screenshots, just follow the link as follows. http://handyham.org/audio/lecture_sample.mp3. In part two, we will discuss some techniques for describing a radio and how to do some audio teaching. I hope you will consider volunteering and helping us add to our collection of audio training lectures. Please visit us online at www.handyham.org and subscribe to our weekly e-letter in HTML or audio, available from the iTunes Store as a free podcast. Our address for contact information is the Courage Center Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, MN 55422. Our toll-free number, 1-866-426-3442. Contact us by email to hamradio, one word, HAMRADIO, at Courage Center, one word, CourageCenter.org. Well, I think it's time to go to HamFest and special events for a few minutes now that class is over for the day. In the month of January, Erie, Pennsylvania, the Straight Key Century Club, SKCC, will broadcast a special event station, K3Y Kilo 3 Yankee, from 0 UTC January 1 to 2359 UTC January 31st to honor 6 years of the organization's growth. It's on all the various frequencies and ranges. If you listen up, you're sure to catch up to it. Waukesha, Wisconsin, a 40th annual Midwinter Ham Radio Computer and Electronic Swap Fest will be held on Saturday, January 7, from 8 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Waukesha County Export Center Forum. Greenwood, South Carolina, the Greenwood Ham Fest will be held Saturday, January 14, at the Piedmont Technical College Multipurpose Building at 620 North Emerald Road, there in Greenwood, South Carolina. Fort Worth, Texas, the Cowtown Hamfest 2012 is on Friday and Saturday, January 20 and 21 at the Lockheed Martin Recreational Center. Palm Springs, California, the Desert Radio Amateur Transmitting Society will hold the Palm Springs Hamfest on Saturday, January 28 from 9:30 a.m. to 4:30 p.m., of course, West Coast time, at The Barn, 4193 Matthew Drive. And there'll be quite a few more in February. The list is very lengthy, so you can see now that the new year has turned to us, it's time to get out there and check the tables and see what we can pick up for cheap or for expensive, whichever way your preferences go, in hamfests all over the United States. We have an interesting article here from the Quarter Century Wireless Association, the QCWA. It's titled The Pilgrimage to the Hammond Museum of Radio. The author is Dave Hayes, H-A-Y-E-S. Dave is an amateur from Canada. Victor Echo 3, Juliet X-ray, VE3, JX. The Quarter Century Wireless Association, by definition, has a great interest in preserving the history of amateur radio. All of its members were first licensed 25 years ago or more. Many members have been licensed for a lot longer, with a few attaining a QCWA Gold Certificate that acknowledges 80 years of service as a licensed radio amateur. It is no wonder our members have a keen interest in radio history. One such member was Fred Hammond, Victor Echo 3, Hotel Charlie, VE3HC, now a Silent Key. He has passed on. In 1929, Fred began collecting early radio and wireless artifacts at age 16. This is when he obtained his first amateur radio license and his lifetime call, VE3HC. With the exception of the war years, he was active on the bands until his death in 1999. Also during this time, the Hammond family built an empire from simple beginnings in a garage to world-renowned manufacturing businesses now known as Hammond Manufacturing Company Limited and Hammond Power Solutions Incorporated. Fred became a member of QCWA in August of 1964 and received QCWA membership number 4297. He was active in both QCWA National and Chapter Affairs, holding a variety of offices such as National Director and President of the Southern Ontario Chapter 73. Overall, Fred was an icon in Canadian amateur radio. He was a founding member of the QCWA chapter, working to build it into one of the largest in the association. After his death, this chapter renamed itself the Fred Hammond Chapter 73. In honor of this great man. Fred was inducted into the Canadian Amateur Radio Hall of Fame in 1996, receiving QCWA's Hall of Fame Award that year. He had been honored in 1989 by QCWA with its Distinguished Service Award. One of Fred's many accomplishments, together with his longtime friend Tom Wong, VE7BC, also a Silent Key, was to bring China back on the air in 1983 with call BY1PK, Bravo Yankee 1, Papa Kilo. He was also a generous and enthusiastic supporter of the American Radio Relay League, the ARRL, and donated Hammond manufacturing cabinets for the ARRL station, W1AW, and ARRL Lab. Apparently, Fred had quite a display of collected radios and artifacts in a small building at the rear of his home in Guelph, Ontario. In 1970, space was reserved in a new Hammond plant on Curtis Street for the new Hammond Museum of Radio. In 1999, the year its founder died, the museum moved to its present larger home in Hammond's Southgate plant on Southgate Drive. The core of the museum is Fred's exhaustive collection, with one-third of the exhibits being items donated by various amateurs and other individuals. The museum now provides a home for hundreds of receivers and transmitters dating from the Spark Gap up to and including National's first solid-state receiver, the HRO-500. The Hammond Museum is now one of North America's premier wireless museums. The cost of touring it is strictly by voluntary donation. The museum is divided into specific sections. The Wireless Age. This section contains examples of early wireless equipment, including a working Marconi 10-inch spark gap transmitter, apparently identical to the one that sent SOS from the Titanic, and a Canadian Marconi crystal detector receiver of the same era. A popular commercial receiver of the time, the IP501, was originally produced by the Wireless Specialties Apparatus Company, and later by RCA. This was a monster. The 501's weight was 87 pounds, and its retail price was $595. And remember, folks, that's a long time ago dollars. Now, as for broadcast features, radio broadcasting started almost 100 years ago, and this museum area has many receivers from the 1920s and 1930s. Among them are table models, mantelpiece models, cathedrals, and floor model consoles. Many Canadian-built radios are here, including names like Rogers, Northern Electric, and Mercury. With regard to military displays, this area is of great interest to those of us who became licensed in the late 40s and to the late 50s. This was the golden age of war surplus. Interestingly, though, this museum has some artifacts from World War I. For example, there is a Marconi QRP spark transmitter used by the RAF in air reconnaissance planes. It provided one-way communication reporting of enemy target locations. No airborne receiver was used. It would have been too heavy. Most of us are more familiar with the equipment used in World War II. This is what was on the market when I became an amateur. Built to military specifications, these transmitters and receivers were second to none. All the major types are on display. There's an interesting Japanese receiver on display as well, captured by the Americans when they retook the Aleutian Islands. It appears to be a knockoff of the National HRO receiver. Factory testing revealed that its specifications were identical to the HRO. It is believed to be the last working model in existence. Now, with regard to amateur equipment, this is the section, along with the military, that brought back so many good memories of when I started out in amateur radio. All the rigs I've used from yesterday were represented. I started out with used Heath kits, an HR-10 receiver, and a DX-35 transmitter with a VF-1 VFO. I later used a Viking Ranger transmitter. For the Collins collector, the museum has an extensive collection of such amateur equipment, everything from complete KW175A4 stations and a mini KWS1 station to KWM1s and 2s are here. The museum has a prototype receiver as well that was being developed by Collins Canada, the 51J5. That project was halted before market production. However, the Hammond Museum has on display one of the only known copies. And there is a radio room as well. While I did not have the time to operate from its well-equipped radio room, I did leave it reluctantly. There are two fine station consoles set up here with two call signs in use, VE3HC, that's Fred's original call, and VE3BJ, which once belonged to Bill Kent, who was on the air from 1908. He was one of the earliest radio pioneers in Canada. In conclusion, my very knowledgeable tour guide was Larry Asp, ASP, amateur call from Canada, VE3RF, a QCWA member associated with the Fred Hammond Chapter 73 in Southern Ontario. Thank you, Larry, for a wonderful time. We hope to repeat it again in the future. The Hammond Museum of Radio has a website, www.hammondmuseumofradio.org. If you plan to be anywhere near Gulp, Ontario, that's spelled G-U-E-L-P-H, Gulp, Ontario, in the future, make a point of stopping in at the Hammond Museum, founded by one of QCWA's greatest members. Thanks, Fred, for providing such a timeless legacy for us all. If you'd like to get in touch with us, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at ve3jx@arrl.net. I think it's time to take a look west. Summer Freeze, Reflections on the 2011 6-meter DX Season by Bill Pasternak, called WA6ITF. So how was your summer DX season on 50 megahertz? I've been around the band since 1959, and in my humble opinion, Solar Cycle 24 is about as bad as it was back in the mid-1960s to the mid-1970s during the solar low of cycle 20. Yes, there was some decent DX, but the summer of 2011 was nothing to QSL home to mama about it. This is especially true if you run a minimalist station such as mine, thanks to CCNRs, covenants, conditions, and restrictions that impact many operators' ability to put up antennas. What is WA6ITF minimalism? It's an AEA loop antenna, about 7 feet off the ground. The antenna is behind a fence and fed by 100 feet of RG8X. There's a photo here. Very not impressive. Through a two-position coaxial switch, it feeds either a Yaesu FD847 or MFJ9604. The 9604 is my 24/7 monitor receiver. I call it the radio that never sleeps, even if I do. From my Southern California QTH, or location, my best 6-meter 2011 DX took place early in the summer when I made contact with Dave Bernhardt and the 7DB in Boring, Oregon. Nothing boring about that. The rest of the season, I was a 6-meter SWL, shortwave listener. Lots of other stations with far better antennas work what small amount of DX there was. I found myself outnumbered by those with low and high power stations, but who had antennas on their roof or a tower that was a part of some location's skyline. That is okay, though, because it can give a minimalist operator like me inspiration as an underdog. I remember Cycle 19 when I first took to the 6-meter airwaves. That was the summer of 1959, when 6 meters was an almost 24-hour-a-day DX band, and a minimalist station of that era could make contacts at an amazing rate. In 1959, and through the very early 1960s, the radios of choice for the 6-meter beginner was either a $39 built-yourself Heathkit HW29-6er, or an 8-watt, $350 gun set communicator 3. Wow. The communicator had one big advantage over the 6er in the form of a super heterodyne receiver. On a gun set, you could separate stations that were operating fairly close together. The 6er, with its super regenerative receiver, lumped all stations within 100 to 150 kilocycles. That's pre-kilohertz. On one spot on the dial, and your only selectivity filter was your, you got it, ears. Even so, kid and adult hams of that time worked a lot of long-distance E and F, too, with the Heath 6er because the band was simply hot night and day. By the way, the 6er was also affectionately known as the Benton Harbor Lunchbox for obvious reasons. It's pictured here on page 39. It looks like a kid's lunchbox. Now, regarding last summer, if we fast forward to the summer of 2011, one could easily say the MFJ9406 is the modern-day SSB single sideband equivalent of a Gonset Communicator 3. Like the Communicator series, the 9406 is simple, straightforward, and at 10 watts peak envelope power, PEP, has a transmitter power level commensurate with the average low-power 6-meter station. Its receiver is as sensitive as you will find for under $300. In reality, both are radios of their time. That said, even if you have the best radio made and an antenna to match, you are not going to work very much DX if the 6-meter band is dead. For minimalist operators, it's even worse. My best frame of reference is the perspective I get from looking through old logs. Sadly, many of mine have been lost to antiquity, but Dave Barnhart, N7DB, has been around the VHF bands for a long time and has developed some statistics that might interest even the most casual 6-meter operator. Dave posted them to the VHF Reflector, and I emailed him for permission to share his data with all of you. Dave very generously said yes. And what follows is a half-century comparison of 6 meters, then and now. In light of the 6-meter DX activity this fall, that's referencing 2011, I thought I would present a comparison of the recent monthly solar flux value to those of past cycles, he writes. Solar spot numbers have their place, however. I prefer to look at solar flux values, as I feel it is a better representation of the level of incoming radiation to the ionosphere. First, we tend to believe a solar cycle is 11 years. Well, that is a nominal value for the duration of a cycle. Let us look at the duration of recent cycles. That's SF Minim to SF Minimum. Cycle 19, June 54 to the July 64. Cycle 20, July 64 to July 76. Cycle 21, July 76 to June 86. Cycle 22, June 86 to October 96. Cycle 23, October 96 to July 08. We can see the duration of cycle 23 was a bit long, but not unlike what was seen with cycle 20. Now, let us examine a monthly solar flux average value for this point in this cycle compared to past cycles. Cycle 19, 267.1. Cycle 20, 136.1. Cycle 21, 217.9. Cycle 22, 225.9. Cycle 23, 158.1. Cycle 24, 137.2. For 6 meters, cycle 19 is the gold standard of F2 propagation. It registered 267.1. At least in the Pacific Northwest, cycles 21 and 22 were not that bad. History. I recall talking to W7FFE, now a silent key, many years ago, and was told he heard or worked EI2W back during cycle 19. Remember, that was on AM, amplitude modulation with relatively low power and small antennas. Europe was so elusive for so many of us in the Pacific Northwest for decades afterwards. Then, in 2001, Europe was into the Pacific Northwest again. Many worked Europe during cycle 23. Now, Europe is even being worked via Summer E from the Pacific Northwest. I stopped counting the number of 6-meter JA, that's Japanese QSOs, worked when I reached 2,500. Yet, as we got into cycle 24, JA openings, certainly into CN85, have become hard to come by. But then, JAs are reaching much farther east into North America. My belief for this shift is due to our changing magnetic latitude. The magnetic North Pole is moving and apparently shifting the propagation patterns in the process. I will admit my earlier assessment of this cycle was not favorable. So far, the DX that has been in has been better than my earlier expectations. One might want to make comparisons to cycle 20, but I am not sure that would be prudent, as I have indicated a change in propagation patterns. What is constant from previous cycles is to stay alert to solar flex levels, solar flare, slant CME events, and AU activity. Posting the propagation, you have also helped others post ionization clouds. The visual information available by seeing the plots on the propagation maps is a great advantage to operators over previous cycles. Getting propagation reports on 28.885 MHz years ago was primitive compared to what is available today. So, we shall see what the cycle actually has in store for us. Our thanks go out to Dave, and now my big question to all readers. Are you on 6 meters, and how have you found solar cycle 24 thus far? If you email me your thoughts, I'll be happy to share them with WRO readers. My email address is wa6itf@arnewsline.org. Now, in Jeopardy, a piece of radio history. Last September's World Radio Online featured a cover picture of the original K6MYK repeater. This was the first ever automatically controlled ham radio repeater, and it was hand-built by the late Arthur M. Gentry, W6MEP, in the 1950s. It now resides in storage at the home of Bill Ahrens, N6NMC, in the city of Santa Clarita, California. Bill inherited the K6MYK system when Art and his wife Millie, K6JJN, retired and moved to Oregon. Both are now deceased. In the intervening years, Bill has replaced the original repeater with modern solid-state gear and obtained ART's W6MEP call sign for the repeater. It's also the reason that the original machine, which is considered to be of great historical value, is currently sharing his home. In fact, the system is in such a historical note that the ARRL would like to have it for eventual display at its Newington, Connecticut headquarters. The problem is how to get it there, and who is going to pay for its transport some 2,850 miles across the United States. The K6MYK repeater has 2 9-foot-tall relay racks loaded with tube equipment. While it's never been weighed, it's likely the 2 fully loaded racks tip the scales at more than 500 pounds. As such, we are talking into the thousands of dollars to properly crate the system and transport it from California to ARRL headquarters. In these days of fiscal austerity, neither Bill nor the ARRL can pay that kind of money. Those who appreciate the value of such historic preservation are asking, any volunteers, cross-country truckers, or people who know them? Everyone involved understands that this is a lot to ask. The fact is, the historic repeater can't stay at N6NMC's home forever. For a piece of gear that literally changed the face of ham radio utility and emergency communications to wind up in some scrap heap would be a tragedy. If you can help or know someone who might, contact Bill Ahrens, A-R-E-N-S. His amateur call, N6NMC, at b.ahrens@att.net. Anything you can do to assist in helping to preserve this piece of ham radio history will be sincerely appreciated. One last comment. Colorado 6-meter beacon is back on the air. A 50 megahertz beacon in Colorado, originally maintained by Glenn and Karen Schultz, and with the call sign W0IJR and KA0CDN, is back in operation. With the passing of W0IJR, the KA0CDN call will be the sole ID for this machine. Amateur call KA0CDN adds that she would appreciate reports of its reception. This information was filed by W6OAL. Folks, we'll conclude with the contest corner. Now that the new year has come around, there's a lot of activity that's beginning to stir on the band throughout the entire month of January and on through the rest of the year. First of all, the big thing on January 1st is Straight Key Night. That's all about CW, or Morse code sending on 80, 40, and 20 meters. It begins at 0 Zulu and concludes 2359 Zulu, January 1. There's Kids Day. That's it. Kids, K-I-D-S, Day. Kids Day, 1800, 2359 Zulu on 8 January. All bands 80 through 10 meters, single sideband. Not 30-meter band, and 2-meter repeaters. A big one, the ARRL-RTTY Roundup, RITTY Roundup, 1800 Zulu 7 January to 2359 Zulu 8 January. And for you CW operators, again, another biggie, North American QSO Party, 1800 Zulu January 7th to 0600 January 8th. That's 160 through 10 meters CW only. North American QSO Party for Voice, single sideband, 160 through 10 meters, is on the weekend of the 14th and 15th of January. If you want to run for the beacon, 0100, 0300 Zulu, 15 January, 80 through 10 meters CW. The ARRL, January VHF sweepstakes, 1900 Zulu, 21 January to 0359 Zulu, 23 January. And there are more, but I think that'll hold most of you listeners for sure. Well, this is Bob Zeta. My amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo, Lima, Foxtrot. I've been reading from World Radio Online for January 2012, a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. We have a great website. It's up to date all the time, gives you a lot of audio information and other details about amateur radio and how to learn to be a ham radio operator with the help of the Courage Handy Ham System. That website is www.handyham.org. Again, this is Bob Zeta, N1BLF. If you'd like to comment to me via email, you can go directly to my email, n1blf@comcast.net. My QTH, or geographic location, is Dartmouth, Massachusetts. 73. Happy New Year again.